You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, friends. Welcome. I'm glad you could join me. My guest today is P.D. Mangan. He is a writer and commentator on health, fitness, and life extension. He's got a great story, too. Years ago, he suffered from chronic fatigue, and he overcame his disorder largely through his own efforts. And he started writing about his experience. Well, since then, he's written 6 books, and he's got a significant presence on Twitter. You can find him at Mangan150. I couldn't wait to get PD on because you can tell the man's done some extra reading and pored over lots of studies. He's a walking wealth of information, someone who thoroughly researches what he writes and speaks about. He's made a career out of keeping a sharp eye out for BS. I have a theory that if you just followed people on Twitter who have a verified history of recognizing BS and sharing that with the world, that could be someone you go to for truth, which is so valuable nowadays. Everybody's always asking, where's Walter Cronkite when you need him? Well, there are people out there who give you the truth. You're not going to find it on the networks and newspapers, which are biased. But there are people online who are quite adept at identifying BS. You can read their blogs and scroll their tweets. You'll see in their tweet history, wow, they were right about that and this and that. People are usually, they're not putting forth the effort to go back and delete their old tweets. So what happens is their feed becomes a treasure trove of truth bombs and predictions of things they thought would turn out a certain way. And sure enough, they did. But I'm not so naive to think everyone cares about the truth. There are many people in this world for whom truth is not a value. Some people seem allergic to the truth. My wife was getting her nails done in Houston, this was a few weeks ago, and she asked the guy what was his name, and he said, B, like Bumblebee. She said, oh yeah, B, like Bumblebee, of course. I think of the truth like a bee. Sometimes it makes a landing on you and you don't even notice, but other times it comes with a sting. But if you went your entire life without getting stung, you wouldn't be as strong as you could be. You wouldn't even know how strong you could be if you'd never been stung. So you just accept that the truth might hurt a little bit, and you learn to accept hard truths as part of the maturation process of living. Hopefully you get to that point, but that should come early. I happen to believe the truth will set you free, thereby improving your lot in life. It may not be comfortable to hear, but nobody ever said growth is comfortable. If it were, everybody would have growth mindset. But they don't. You have to put in the consistent work. Like today's sponsor, 1% Athletics, where they believe the secret to success lies in each one of us. And it starts with your daily disciplines and habits. All too often, people will set a goal for themselves, get discouraged, and give up. And the reason is they're focused on the result instead of the daily growth that comes with the process. There's no clarity around how to get the results they seek. So what can you do? Well, you first gain clarity of where you see yourself in the future, then you focus on getting 1% better every single day. Because once you get enough days of 1% gains, what happens is your growth begins to accelerate. Next thing you know, you're way ahead of where you even imagined you'd be. That's the power of 1%. And that's what 1% Athletics is all about, inspiring people, getting 1% better, so that one day you'll live the life you ultimately desire. Be sure to follow at 1%_athletics on Instagram to see product releases and a small dose of motivation. Or you can visit them at their website, www.1percentathletics.com. They have some cool gear, and there you can be part of the hashtag Team 1% family. I was talking about seeking truth. It's no secret some people would rather swaddle themselves in a warm blanket of bullshit than deal with uncomfortable truths. those who swaddle themselves in blankets are probably allergic to truth and bees. But finding those in the world who have a serious track record of calling out BS, that's the sort of cheat code that growth-minded truth seekers could use in their life. Think about it. Writers now maintain their own blogs and tweet anonymously so that they can maintain their job and their livelihood, because it's at risk in the cancel culture. So you've got CIA operatives or doctors who've been given the gag order by hospital administrators regarding COVID who are risking their jobs and their livelihoods if they were to show their face and share their opinions online. So they do it under a pseudonym. Anonymous accounts have become invaluable because they can share what's really going on without any fear of cancellation. And it allows you and me to have a place where we can go to consistently get the truth. We don't have to switch back and forth from CNN to Fox News to Wall Street Journal to New York Times. What we're doing there is just getting both sides of the argument. You still have to do the work to come to your own conclusion after hearing both sides of the argument. Yeah, right. Most people are not doing that. I realize that. But I just want to remind you, there are people out there who cut through the fluff so you don't have to. If you seek them, you will find. And my guest today happens to be one of those people. He will shoot you straight. If you're somebody who prefers lies that make you feel good, then this might not be the episode for you. As far as it concerns health and fitness, PD has done the work consistently and will tell you the truth. But hey, before you go, if you're one of those folks, I just want to tell you, wise up. We are at a serious inflection point in our country's history. I don't know if we're headed towards civil war or not, but we'd be wise to wise up quickly. It's okay. The truth will only sting for a bit. My man PD recognized early on how mainstream health authorities were screwing us over. Their ideas were wrong, for the most part. But thanks to PD and men like him, we have a much better idea of what we can do to be truly healthy and fit. His willingness to share all that he's learned has enriched my life personally, especially the parts about extending your lifespan and health span. The stuff that I've learned from him will stick with me for 30, 40, maybe 50, 60 years. We'll see. There's wisdom I got from Nassim Taleb regarding my personal finances. He said, you never want to take financial advice from somebody who has to work for a living. Well, you wouldn't want to take health and fitness advice from someone in their 60s unless they look like P.D. Mangan. So I ask a ton of questions. I start by asking him about research on how humans evolved, because I'm infinitely curious about early humans. He shares how hunter-gatherers lived thousands of years ago. We have a lot to learn from them in how they ate and how they worked, how much leisure time they had. And maybe what I found most interesting was how they slept or how much they slept. Because on a previous episode, you may remember, we talked about there's a book written by Matthew Walker called Why We Sleep. Matthew Walker is a neuroscientist and director of the Center for Human Sleep Science at Cal Berkeley. Well, PD disagrees strongly with many of Walker's conclusions on sleep. So that's something we discuss. Something else he talks about is how much things have changed just in the last, say, 120 years. So the turn of last century, like early 1900s. Why didn't they suffer from the chronic diseases that we suffer from nowadays, like heart disease and cancer? We're going to talk about that. I share with PD which supplements I take, and I ask if there's anything that he would add or subtract if he were me. You may find that information helpful. I sure did. And we have a fantastic fun questions at the end. I give him some true or false questions, which I haven't done before. So I ask, in the next 100 years, human lifespans will be no longer finite, true or false? I ask if he were the coach of a team that was competing for a $2 million prize, and he had to get the folks on that team in shape, which according to him, ideally in shape or the ideal weight is half your waist size. So I ask, how would he go about getting his team to half of their, I'm sorry, your waist size should be less than half your height. How would you go about getting your team to less than half their height, each individual? I think you'll be surprised by his answer. So we talk a lot about diet versus exercise, intermittent fasting, CrossFit. We cover quite a bit. Before I bring him on, I want to give a big thank you to my team for helping me with this interview. It wouldn't have happened without you. So Nick Conley, Jackie, Paval, thank y'all. I appreciate your hard work. Please enjoy my chat with Mr. P.D. Mangan. P.D., I have long admired your work, man. Welcome and thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot, Brad. It's great. Thanks for inviting me. Great to be here.
I find the research and writing you've done on early humans to be fascinating. What they ate, how much they slept or didn't sleep, how much leisure time they had. I love all that stuff. Can you give me some insight into how hunter-gatherers lived and maybe talk about which aspects of their daily lives, for health reasons, we should probably be trying to incorporate into our daily living?
Well, to my mind, the paradigm of, let's call it the paleo paradigm, is a very powerful one for looking at health. So hunter-gatherers are those people that are living a very traditional, you might even say Stone Age, way of life. And as you can imagine, there aren't too many of them left in the world, but there are some. And they have been studied a fair amount. So if you go back in time to more than about 10,000 years ago, everybody on Earth lived this way. That's why it's a powerful paradigm for health. So if you look to see how human beings evolved and in what conditions they lived, presumably, you know, to the extent that we know, they did not suffer from any of the same chronic diseases that we suffer from, then we can have a pretty good idea of how that affects our health and what went wrong with the modern world. The hunter-gatherers of today are fairly marginalized people. So, you know, in the old days that I was talking about, the old days beyond 10,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers had the whole earth to themselves because we were all hunter-gatherers. Now the hunter-gatherers that are left do not. They've been crowded out by the modern world. They've been getting crowded out for quite some time since agriculture. People like the hunter-gatherers of southern Africa, they're living on very marginalized land. It's very dry and dusty, sparse vegetation, and so on. So the reason why I mention that is because when we're looking at hunter-gatherers of today, we can't necessarily say, well, that's how human beings always live. You got to make these distinctions. So, you know, what would it be like, for example, to be a hunter-gatherer in the middle of Europe? There are none there today. So conditions would be a lot different, different climate, presumably much more abundance in animals and vegetation and so on. So how do the hunter-gatherers live and what's important about it? Obviously, all their food has to be either hunted or gathered. So hunted would be animal foods, gathered would be plant foods. They seem to prefer animal foods over plant foods. So in one study of a number of different hunter-gatherer societies, they found that these hunter-gatherers would basically eat as much animal food as they could get, and that in a nutshell, the only reason they were eating any plant foods was because animal foods were relatively scarce. They couldn't get enough of them. Nevertheless, they found that the majority of these hunter-gatherer societies were getting the majority of their food from animal foods. So mainly meat we'd be talking about there. In that way, they are free of chronic disease. They have no heart disease or cancer that we're aware of. They certainly are not obese. They are less active than you might think. One of the sort of retorts people come up with when you discuss this idea is, well, they're, you know, of course they're not obese because they're running around all day and working hard and all this kind of stuff. But in fact, they have lots of leisure time. and they might put in 4 hours of fairly active hunting or labor of some kind, but they do have plenty of leisure time. So that's not it. There was one scientific study that found that hunter-gatherers expend no more energy overall than Western people do. And some of that may be due to the fact that when they're not being physically active, making a living, they actively seek out leisure. They sit around a lot. They rest, and they don't necessarily want to work hard either. So they do what they can to fulfill their needs. They sleep less, apparently, than Westerners. You know, the average hunter-gatherer was sleeping 6.5 hours a night. However, that was characterized by really good sleep. They just go to sleep and wake up 6.5 hours later, unlike us in the West. Naps were rare. I think we can take some clues from them as to, you know, why they are healthy, why they're free from chronic disease, and why we're not.
Would they eat to the cubic capacity of their stomach?
Well, they certainly eat their fill. When they get a large kill, they will be eating it. Obviously, food cannot be preserved well in that sort of environment. No refrigerators, obviously. There have been some hunter-gatherer societies that figured out ways to preserve food. American Indians, for example, with pemmican. But on the whole, food spoils. So, you know, so they eat it right away and they eat their fill. And they may not go out again looking for more food unless they're hungry again or until they are.
Many people cite the work of Matthew Walker for the reason that you should get X amount of sleep. Are you more a proponent of getting more like 6 to 6.5 hours like hunter-gatherers did?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. there's a very very good article on the web about the errors that are in Matthew Walker's book. And I would urge anyone interested in this to read it. I have been interested in this topic for some time, the topic of sleep. So to give a quick answer to your question, no, I wouldn't necessarily recommend a certain amount of sleep for anyone. While sleep is obviously important, some people seem to take it to this extreme that, you know, if you don't get 8 hours of a night of sleep, you're going to fall over dead. It is just not that way. For example, there's an interesting study, the largest one that I'm aware of, and it is an epidemiological study. In other words, observational. So causation cannot be shown, strictly correlation. But they looked at a large number of people and looked at how long they slept a night, and then what their mortality rate was. And they found that the lowest mortality rate was around 7 hours a night. So that appeared, again, it's not causation, but that appeared to be the optimal amount of sleep in terms of association. And what was interesting about this study is that fairly large increases in mortality did not begin to appear with less sleep until it was under something like 5 hours a night. In other words, there were plenty of seemingly healthy people sleeping between 5 and 7 hours a night. They got away with that. They were fine. Another interesting part of this study is that increases in mortality were seen less sleep than you might think. In other words, people who got more than 8.5 hours of sleep a night had a significantly higher death rate. Now, again, not causation, it's only correlation. Some of these people may have been ill, and that's why they slept longer, or depressed, and that's why they slept longer. We don't know. The thing is that we don't appear to need as much sleep as people think, and that I think the takeaway lesson from that is that if you're not getting 8 hours of sleep a night, there's not necessarily any reason to worry about it. And certainly another important corollary to this They found that sleeping pills are quite dangerous, that they're associated with a much higher mortality rate. And so the problem is, you know, people go to their doctors and say, well, I'm not sleeping 8 hours a night. There's something wrong. I've got insomnia. And so they get prescribed a sleeping pill. Some people stay on those for long term, and that's not good. So it's good to know. It's good to have some perspective on this whole sleep thing. This, by the way, this article that I was talking about that I would urge people to read if they're interested, it's called something like Why Matthew Walker's Book is Riddled with Errors. This author uncovered a lot of them. And unfortunately, people are taking a lot of what he says at face value and very seriously. I've seen this myself with on Twitter, for example. Let's just say I'm skeptical.
It's like with anything, we should probably seek wise counsel than draw our own conclusions. You're going to get conflicting information on almost any topic. I remember the radio host Michael Savage saying a lot that lack of sleep never killed anybody. And I've never known anybody who's died from a lack of sleep. But Matthew Walker was very convincing on the Joe Rogan Experience. And one of the things he advocated for was melatonin to be used only for jet lag. He said it was efficacious only for jet lag, and that sort of stuck with me. So I haven't used melatonin since I learned that from him. But again, you could get conflicting information elsewhere. But melatonin wouldn't necessarily fall under the same category as Ambien or one of these other sorts of sleep medications.
That's right. It wouldn't necessarily, although some people do take high doses of melatonin. I don't know, obviously, what Matthew Walker said on the Joe Rogan show, but if he said that, I would tend to agree with him. I mean, if you need melatonin to sleep, I think the thing to ask yourself is, why do I need melatonin to sleep? I mean, it is a natural hormone. So, presumably, if there are any dangers, and there don't appear to be, they would be far less than for a sleeping pill. So no, it is not in the same category as sleeping pills.
I think a lot of people are struggling with sleep right now because one of the best ways to get good sleep is to have a productive day. And people are pretty sedentary right now in lockdown. And so it's messing with their sleep. So I think a good discussion on sleep and different perspectives on it is helpful. Another thing you've written about that I found interesting was turn of the century, and not this most recent century, but 19th and 20th century, so around the year 1900. We're not talking about that long ago. People my age were talking about eight ancestors. It would be our grandparents' parents, basically. I'm 40, for those listening. What is it that you learned about how they lived versus how we live now, and what are the big scary changes that have occurred in just that short time span of 120 years?
Yes, this is all very interesting because I think it really goes to the crux of the matter as to why we in the modern age, in the modern West, suffer from so many chronic diseases like heart disease and cancer. In the late 19th century, there were, this was the advent of what is known as ultra-processed food. And ultra-processed food, it's a term of art because all food is processed in some way or another. And I mean, unless you're picking an apple off a tree and eating it, then virtually everything you eat has some kind of processing done to it. Ultra-processed food is the kind of food that comes in boxes and bags, and it's in the middle aisles of the supermarket and has colorful labels and brand names. Americans eat a huge amount of them, 60 to 70% of their calories as ultra processed foods. So what is wrong with these ultra processed foods? Well, to go back to your question about the turn of the century. So in the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, white flour was developed on a mass scale. Obviously, with the Industrial Revolution, there's all kinds of machinery that came into being, and they figured out how to make white flour. So people started consuming white flour. Another thing was vegetable oils, or as I usually refer to them, seed oils. So these are things like corn, soybean oil, safflower oil, canola oil. These are seed oils. So they're not made from vegetables, they're made from seeds. Never before in human history, except perhaps in small amounts, did people consume seed oils, because there's, as you can imagine, in many of these things, for example, corn, you wouldn't think, you're looking at a corn on the cob, you wouldn't think there's a lot of oil in there, and there isn't. So they require, you know, industrial type extraction to get that amount of, you know, get enough oil from it. So this machinery and these methods were developed to make seed oils or vegetable oils. Then a third element was sugar. So sugar has existed for longer than the late 19th century, for hundreds of years in the West. But what happened is it became significantly cheaper. You go back like to the time of, let's say, Henry VIII, and he was using sugar, but he was the only one around that could afford it because it was so expensive. Get up to the late 19th century, and it's a lot cheaper. People are eating pounds of the stuff yearly. So you put all those together, and you've got ultra-processed foods, and they are cheap ingredients, and they are very profitable for food companies because the ingredients are so cheap. There's allegedly something like only 5 cents worth of actual grain in a box of cereal. It might retail for $5 or $6. What happened? So roundabout up to, let's say, 1900, people were eating a much more traditional diet. And then they started eating a lot more white flour and sugar. Around 1910, Crisco was introduced. So Crisco is a hydrogenated vegetable oil, and there was a successful advertising campaign about it to convince people to use it. And it was a lot cheaper than the animal fats, and it would preserve better and so on. So people started using that. And then they started using the seed oils too. They were advertised for the same reason, as being less expensive and easier to preserve. Around 1900, heart attacks were basically non-existent. The first recorded heart attack that we know of happened in the late 18th century. There were cardiologists in the mid 20th century saying that when they trained, nobody told them about heart attacks because there weren't any. The cardiologists were doing different things, not dealing with heart attacks. Anyway, the rate of heart attacks rose starting around 1910, and it rose, it doubled again until you got to the peak at about 1965, when you had an epidemic of heart attacks in the United States. You had, we're talking about middle-aged men clutching their chests and dropping over dead. This was all too common. People wanted to know what to do about it. President Eisenhower in 1955 had a heart attack. And so this was front page news. And everybody's wondering, wow, heart attack, you know, what causes this, and so on. I should mention one other thing, possibly not so germane to this general idea that we're getting on here. But in 1900, hardly anybody smoked cigarettes. So tobacco use was obviously pretty widespread, but people smoked cigars or chewed tobacco or whatever. But cigarettes were pretty uncommon. And machine manufacturing of cigarettes came into being, and they became cheap, and they became more widespread and fashionable. So that in 1900, the, you know, annual per capita consumption of cigarettes was, you know, something like 50 cigarettes a year, whereas you get up to 1965, and it was something like 4,000 cigarettes a year was the annual per capita consumption. So that's the difference. And cigarettes are obviously a driver of heart disease and lung cancer too. They didn't find that out till later. So that was another factor that was different. The thing is, now we're all very aware of the dangers of cigarette smoking, and anybody who's reasonably health conscious does not do it. However, we're not aware of these other things that I've been talking about. So that's a difference between 1900 and today. So now today, the average American consumes something like 120 pounds of sugar a year. a huge fraction of the calories we consume are ultra-processed foods. So we got the white flour. Seed oils are a very underrated element of ill health, in my opinion. That's just hardly known by anybody. That is around 1900, the population took this hit that eventually resulted in chronic disease. Now, let me update the story totally to the present day. We took another hit in the late 1970s. So I was telling you about these heart attacks, and everybody wanted to know, what do we do? How do we stop middle-aged men from dying of heart attacks? And the solution they came up with was, it's all cholesterol. It's high cholesterol that's causing heart attacks. How do you get high cholesterol? Well, it's caused by eating a bunch of saturated fat, and meat and other animal foods are relatively high in saturated fat. So these were demonized. This came to a head in the late 1970s when the U.S. government had a commission and formalized the first dietary guidelines recommending a high carbohydrate diet and low in saturated fat. This was the beginning of the obesity epidemic. Obesity rates were quite low in the United States up until that time. Now it's a massive problem. There are other factors, but the dietary guidelines they recommended certainly play into it. So that's where we stand now.
It's interesting to hear you talk about sugar and how it's something that the wealthy used to use, and now it's relatively a poor and middle class, that's who's consuming sugar nowadays. There are other things that have done the reverse, where they were prevalent among the lower classes, and now they're prevalent among the upper classes, like tattoos, like cigarettes. You know, when you travel to Romania, cigarettes are a status symbol because it displays that you have money to throw away, basically. I find it so fascinating. People who you look at would never, you think if you lived in the States, you would not smoke. You're too pretty, or you're too sophisticated. Or my best friend's mom, when she was at the University of Texas in Austin in the 60s, joined a sorority and they taught them how to smoke. So that's how refined it was back then.
Obesity is another one. 100 years ago or more, maybe, if you were overweight, that means you could afford food and you didn't have to work too hard physically. And that's changed too.
So, exactly, you know, right.
The upper classes are not generally, there's plenty of overweight among them, but generally they are not as overweight as people with a lower income. I mean, you don't see too many, let's say, corporate CEOs of Fortune 500 companies that are obese.
So true.
It's just not that way.
Theodore Dalrymple is a British author who wrote a great book called Life at the Bottom. And he talks about all of these things that lower class people once did that the upper classes have now adopted. And it's interesting to hear you talk about obesity because you're right. We're fighting an imaginary enemy that is food insecurity because our poorest zip codes are the most obese. It's incredible, but it's not the only imaginary enemy we're fighting in America right now. In 1900, life expectancy was 48 years old. And from what I see in North America now, it's crept above 80 years old. Is this only due to infant mortality rate dropping?
It is not due solely to infant mortality rate dropping, but that is a big one for sure. If a number of people die before the age of 5, let's say, that's obviously going to skew the average life expectancy of a population. So it might have been something like 47, like you were saying. So if you reached the age of maturity, if you reached, say, 16 to 18 years old, what were your chances of living a long life? And certainly plenty of people, they were good. The chances were good. You know, so plenty of people, once you got to adulthood, you had a good chance of living into your 70s. Into your 80s would have been considered pretty old for sure. There's also been some other developments. You know, medicine, the techniques of medicine have gotten a lot better. So, you know, what's happening now is that people, life expectancy is actually at the moment not rising. It's even declining slightly. But you also see longer maximum lifespans. So you see a number of people. I mean, now living into the 90s is nothing unusual at all. You see it all the time. It's even not that uncommon. You know, if somebody hits 100 years old, you no longer think, wow, you know, because you see this in the news or you know people or whatever. So that's fairly common. So we did have, yes, there was a large decline in infant mortality. There was also the advent of antibiotics. So that happened in the 1940s. And so diseases that were killing people before no longer killed them. Tuberculosis, pneumonia, these things were important causes of death in 1900. And they became less so as time went on. It's better, like I say, with the advent of antibiotics, with the lowering of infant mortality, better sanitation is a huge one. That dynamic of better sanitation has been going on for quite some time, since let's call it 1800. And that has led to better life expectancy. So, and in fact, things like better medical technology or vaccinations are a relatively unimportant reason why life expectancy has increased since 1900.
I was watching your YouTube channel, Rogue Health and Fitness, and I heard you talk about the establishment lying to us about saturated fat and the fact that we should, or not fact, but the idea that we should be eating a bunch of small meals. I used to tell people one of the reasons I kept lean, speaking of correlation, not causation, one of the reasons I kept lean was because I ate a bunch of small meals, and I even had a term for it. I called it stoking the fire. Based on what we know now, two questions. When you refer to the establishment, who are you referring to? And secondly, was good health information kept behind the nefarious institutional gates, or is this just new science that has come out?
Okay, so yeah, good question. So who is the health establishment? By that term, I'm referring to academic medical experts. I'm referring to people in the government that deal with these sort of things. I am referring to big pharmaceutical companies who have a huge influence over the way medicine is practiced and taught. And then the going down a step, then the sort of the average doctor who, you know, was taught all this and so on. So the health establishment is all those people. Like I said, the pharmaceutical companies have a big influence on medical education and the way medicine is practiced, bigger than you might think. This is certainly not a conspiracy theory. They're very much involved, and they want to make sure that they make money by selling their drugs. I mean, it's just that simple. Why wouldn't they? That is the health establishment. As for saturated fat, the way I look at it is that way back when, well, not so long ago, but the 60s and 70s, when it was decided that cholesterol was a problem and that saturated fat was a problem for health, everybody got into line. There were prominent scientists at the time that objected to all this, that were skeptical about it, and they had their careers ruined. John Yudkin is a well-known one. He was an advocate that sugar was the main problem for health as far as our diet went. And there were others that were just totally skeptical about the idea that cholesterol causes heart disease and that saturated fat raised cholesterol, so it caused heart disease. But they were either ignored or slandered. But basically, everybody else got on board. And this was broadcast far and wide. As I mentioned, the dietary guidelines came out. And this has been going on now since, let's call it 1980. They were telling us to eat in a fundamentally different way from the way people have always eaten. If people are allowed to naturally choose their foods, they're not going to eat this way. And so they were telling us to eat, to cut the fat out of our diets. And of course, you have to increase carbs because you got to eat something. So if you're not eating fat, you're going to eat carbohydrates. Also, the food companies jumped in with all the low fat stuff. And, you know, sugar is low fat. And so, you know, for a long time, even the health establishment didn't see anything much wrong with sugar. They've changed their tune a little bit on that now. But in any case, in my humble opinion, it's been a disaster. And now we've got still, and here's another thing I read and hear every day. My doctor wants me on a statin. The doctors want every middle-aged man to be taking a statin. That's really not much of an exaggeration. Your cholesterol is too high. So all of this flows from the idea that saturated fat is bad and that cholesterol causes heart disease. So this has been going on, like I say, I know I'm repeating myself, but it's been going on for 40 years. Can they just turn around now and say, oops, we made a mistake?
Most people don't do that.
No. There are careers involved. There's a lot of money involved. There are lives involved. There's health involved. It would be, if they did that, why would you ever believe anything that anyone like that ever said again?
And it could be litigation city.
Yeah. So that's not going to happen. People who spent their careers saying this are not going to turn around and say, you know, no, we were wrong. And so they're still preaching the same message. I mean, you know, for me and people like me and, you know, people that I'm in contact with and people that I read and people who read what I write and say, you know, we're in this little group. We understand, you know, what's going on. Most of us are eating low carbohydrate, real whole foods. We understand what kind of a disaster the whole thing has been. But the vast majority of the population are not hearing that message. They're hearing that a ketogenic diet will kill you. They're hearing that, you know, you got to take a statin to avoid a heart attack, that you've got to keep your cholesterol low, that I started eating low carb and my LDL went up, so I stopped. All this kind of thing. Meanwhile, in the last 10 years, there have been several meta-analyses. So a meta-analysis is basically a study of studies. So a group of researchers will get together and say, let's look at saturated fat. Let's look at all the studies that have been done about saturated fat and mortality and see what they say. Put it all together in one great, you know, examine it closely and put it all together in one great big result. There have been at least three of these meta-analyses that I'm aware of, and they've all found that saturated fat is not associated with heart disease. Meanwhile, they're overlooking what is, in my opinion, the most important cause of chronic disease, and that is insulin resistance.
Do you think that what the experts proclaimed when I was born had just become groupthink? And how fearful does that make you of other sorts of groupthink as it pertains to the CDC and WHO and COVID and climate change? There was a book written recently called Apocalypse Never, where one of these scientists is going the other way now. Like I said earlier, it's imperative for us to seek the wise counsel of a bunch of different experts and then draw our own conclusion. But in your situation, someone who's written six books, you're probably skeptical of everybody.
Yeah. 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 I'm skeptical of everybody. This whole thing, the COVID thing, you know, two major medical journals published articles about hydroxychloroquine treatment, concluding that it was no good, that it did not work. And both of these, one was in the New England Journal of Medicine, one was in The Lancet. These are two of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. And it was found out that the data was falsified. They couldn't rely on anything. That it was you know, if people were a little more aware of this, I mean, it's scandalous what happened. So why should I believe anything they say? The thing, the apocalypse never thing, it's the same thing. I mean, you know, I'm extremely skeptical of that stuff. People are always trying to sell you a bill of goods. You know, there's a lot of other areas that I'm skeptical about, but certainly in the area of health and fitness and nutrition, I'm very skeptical. The health establishment is not just going to turn around and reverse themselves or say, well, they're not even going to say, yeah, maybe there's a little truth to what you're saying. They're not even going to do that. There's no backing down. They're going to lose face massively if they did that.
Their identity's too tied up in their opinion.
Their identity and their livelihoods and their credibility as experts. Yeah.
I know that you suffered from chronic fatigue. Is that what prompted you to write the book Dumping Iron?
No, not exactly. But I had chronic fatigue, and that's what inspired me to get into writing about health and fitness. And one thing led to another, and eventually I did write Dumping Iron. So it's indirectly related.
Mm. I have a doctor friend, and tell me if you've heard a similar story, and I know it's contrary to your book, but he was having terrible headaches, and he had tried everything and visited all his doctor friends. And finally, someone suggested that he get an iron injection, and he did, and it's changed his life. Now, I get terrible headaches too, and I've tried iron supplementation, not injection, but it left me constipated for a week. It didn't help me. I just want to get your thoughts. Had you ever heard a story that iron was a miracle worker for someone and then didn't help the next person?
Certainly, iron deficiency anemia is a real thing. And so iron is a required nutrient, but the people most likely to suffer from iron deficiency anemia are women of childbearing age. So the figures I've seen about the prevalence of iron deficiency anemia in the United States, if I recall correctly, were somewhere around the order of 2% of the adult population. And iron deficiency can be a serious problem as well, especially in children. As children are growing up, they need a source of iron. And this has been a problem in children raised as vegans. And it can lead to long-term developmental disabilities if they don't get enough iron at the time when they're developing and they require it. So, yeah, iron deficiency is real. I don't deny that. You know, human beings and basically virtually all living things do require iron. As far as, you know, someone like you were talking about, let's say an adult man can have iron deficiency as well. Usually, I mean, if an adult man went to a doctor complaining, you know, having various symptoms, fatigue would be a prominent one. And it was found that that this person was iron deficient. What they want to do is find out why. Because bleeding is a source, you know, undetected bleeding, occult bleeding, they call it, is a source of iron deficiency, and cancer can be a source of occult bleeding. So, you know, that's one of the things they would want to find out why. So, yeah, iron deficiency is real, but in adult men, pretty uncommon.
And this bleeding, is that the reason women have less iron than men?
That's correct.
Okay. And can you talk about iron levels around the world?
In the Western world, we seem to have higher iron levels. So iron accumulates in our bodies. We have a regulated mechanism for how much we absorb from our diets, but we have no regulated way of getting rid of it. And with metabolic dysfunction and various other problems, iron can accumulate in our bodies. Middle-aged men might have 4 to 5 times the amount of iron in their bodies as a middle-aged woman, and they have higher rates of disease as well. When women go through menopause and afterwards, they gradually, but very slowly, catch up to men in terms of the iron levels in their bodies. And so we can accumulate iron in our bodies over a lifetime. There are other things going on too. For example, in the United States, all corn and flour, corn meal and flour are fortified with iron by law. So this comes back to this, you know, 2% of the adult population who are iron deficient, the women of childbearing age. It was thought that, well, if we do this, if we fortify the food, we'll get rid of iron deficiency. But they didn't think about the fact that everybody's consuming this iron and ingesting it. Added iron to food and iron in supplements or vitamins may be more readily absorbed by and bypass this regulatory mechanism that we have and may lead to more accumulation of iron. So there's a lot of interesting work about high iron leading to disease. Blood donors, for example, have lower rates of many chronic diseases. There have been controlled trials of bloodletting. So, you know, blood donation and bloodletting are the surest ways of lowering the iron level because the blood is the biggest source, the biggest storage depot, let's put it that way, of iron in our body. So there are a lot of indications in experimental animals. High iron can shorten their lifespans and low iron can lengthen them. So, you know, there's all kinds of indications of the importance of iron in chronic disease and long life, but not too many people are paying much attention to it.
I would agree. Is Best Supplements for Men your most recent book?
Yes. So it is my most recent one. And so since then, I've concentrated on writing, you know, fitness and health programs that are not in book form and putting them up on Gumroad. So there are videos and text with these.
I want to share with you the supplements I take because I've shared the supplements I take on the podcast before, and I've had several listeners contact me and say they bought the same thing. And I want to put this disclaimer out. Please don't take health advice from my podcast host, but I want to share with you what I take and get your thoughts. And then maybe you can tell me what you would take, what you would add or subtract if you were my age, and then give advice for supplementation for kids. So I take a B complex. I take 4,000 IU of vitamin D. I take 500 milligrams of magnesium. And that's it. That's all I take.
Okay. So first thing that needs to be said is that if someone is eating a good diet of real whole foods, you know, hopefully supplementation would be not or only minimally necessary. That said, not too many people do that. And there's also an issue of you know, degradation of soil, so not enough minerals in the food we eat and that sort of thing. So that said, the first thing about your B complex is that would be one of the things that if you ate a diet of real whole foods, that you probably wouldn't need extra of B complex. The second thing is vitamin D. So that's, yeah, I take vitamin D myself, 5,000 IUs when it's not summertime and I'm not getting sun. Vitamin D deficiency and vitamin D insufficiency is widespread. So yeah, that's pretty solid. Sunlight, it would be the preferred source of vitamin D because sunlight does other things besides give you vitamin D, like, for example, increasing nitric oxide production, which is good for arterial health. But obviously, not everybody can do that. People live in the north, depending, you know, it might be winter, you know, all kinds of things going on. I mean, for example, I find myself, like right now, it's too hot out. It's, you know, I don't want to go out in the sun really much. I go out in the morning. The other one you mentioned was magnesium. That's also a solid one. I take magnesium myself. Many, many people are deficient in magnesium. And again, hopefully with a real whole foods diet, you would be getting plenty of magnesium. But that's something that I want to take, make sure I get. Certain conditions, stress, drinking alcohol, drinking coffee can result in wasting of magnesium. You excrete more magnesium. I do take vitamin D and magnesium myself. What I would add for a middle-aged and up man, vitamin K2 is a very interesting one. So vitamin K2 is important for arterial health. What vitamin K2 does, you could look at it this way, is it makes sure that calcium goes to your bones and not your arteries. The thing is, vitamin K2 is, you know, relatively difficult to get in your diet. One of the large sources of it is pastured dairy products. So, for example, like Kerrygold butter would be a source of vitamin K2. There is some in other dairy products, and there is some in meat too. I want to make sure that I'm getting enough, so I take a vitamin K2 supplement. So that's another one.
Anything else you would add?
So I've recently been taking 500 milligrams of vitamin C a day. Again, this is something that I don't know. I'm actually kind of agnostic on it. But with COVID-19 going around, it seemed a reasonable addition to what I wanted to do. So that's something I've been doing just recently. I don't know if I'm going to keep doing it in perpetuity. There's with vitamin C, there's an interesting downside that most people don't consider. And it's been found that large amounts of vitamin C might block the beneficial effects of exercise. So there have been some studies that found that people who are taking 1 gram of vitamin C a day did not show certain markers of getting benefit from exercise. They would put these people through, you know, whatever they did, 6 weeks of training or something like that, all the while taking a gram of vitamin C a day. It was also, there was also an amount of vitamin E in there. So that's important too, because we don't really know what was going on, you know, exactly, precisely. But so they were taking both. But so large amounts of vitamin C might be able to do that, blocking some of the beneficial effects of exercise.
When is the first time you heard the words intermittent fasting?
Not sure recently, but, you know, let's say 10 years ago, I heard about it. And it was a pretty wild concept. I got to admit, the idea that you would deliberately not eat, I learned more about it and I tried it. And it's a pretty solid part of my routine now. I usually fast 16 hours daily. So sleep is, for those who don't know about it, sleep time counts. So if you don't eat after your evening meal and then don't eat until late the next morning or noon or something like that, you've done an intermittent fast of a fairly good length. So that's what I do. It's a very healthy practice.
I'm reminded of Chris Rock's bit on Robitussin. I don't know if you remember this live performance that Chris Rock gave probably 20 years ago, but he talks about Robitussin being the cure-all. And when you're little and you run out, your mom will fill it with water, shake it up, and then you got more Tussin, is what he would say. I think of intermittent fasting as sort of the Robitussin for dietary issues, sort of the cure-all, where everybody's going to it. So have you eaten today at all or not yet?
Yes, I have eaten today. I did my resistance training this morning and I did it fasted, but I always eat afterwards.
So what did
yes,
you eat?
I have eaten. What did I eat? I ate a cup of non-fat yogurt with a scoop of whey protein added to it. But I've also had lunch. I had meat for lunch.
Nice. And so when will you go without food? What time today?
So I'll have a regular, you know, meal, let's say 6 p.m. and then probably won't have anything to eat after that until, let's say, 10 a.m. tomorrow, other than, coffee or tea in the morning. So that's 16 hours.
Are you sold on the health benefits of kombucha?
No, I'm not. Not denying that it's possible there could be some, but no, not sold on it.
Okay, you eating yogurt is what made me think about it.
Yeah, I don't necessarily do that for any kind of lactobacillus or anything like that. However, fermented dairy, which yogurt is, just as is cheese, is healthier than milk. So I don't drink milk. Milk has lactose in it, which is a sugar. And so fermented dairy products are healthier. And so that's what I do. And it's, yogurt's a good source of protein. Non-fat yogurt is low in calories. I'm not a calorie counter, but it is low in calories. So I like it for that reason.
When I was coming up, proper form at the gym was very important. All of a sudden, you had CrossFit break out all over the country and proper form no longer seemed important. Where do you stand on proper form at the gym? And I want to know if how often you should go to failure with your reps.
Proper form is extremely important. And from what I have seen, I've never performed CrossFit myself. I've just seen a few videos of it. But let's just say I'm not impressed with their form. And I don't think that. So the way of looking at this is when you're doing any kind of training or any kind of exercise, what's the number one consideration you want to give to that training or exercise? What should be uppermost in your mind? The one thing that should be uppermost in your mind, the one thing you want to do is do not get injured. Mm-hmm. So you do not get injured by using, you use proper form to avoid getting injured. And CrossFit looks, everything I've seen of CrossFit looks to me like an injury waiting to happen. And so there was actually, so CrossFit successfully sued somebody for claiming that they had a higher rate of injuries in CrossFit. So I'm not claiming that I know what the injury rate in CrossFit is. All I'm saying is I wouldn't do it. Proper form is extremely important. As far as conventional weight training, the big mistake that, if you go into a regular gym and you go in with all the bros working out in the weight room and so on, the big mistake that people are making is lifting weights that are too heavy for them. And in other words, they're too heavy to maintain proper form. And then that's how people get injured doing weight training. If you have a weight that's too heavy for you to move in proper form, then you're using momentum or jerking weights around. Your muscles and tendons and joints get put into positions they're not meant to be in with a lot of weight on them, and you get injured. Here's another way of looking at it. The key, and I keep saying the key, I guess there's a lot of keys. One of the important things about resistance training, the purpose is not to move a weight or resistance from place to place. That's not the purpose at all. The purpose is to effectively load your muscles so that you can give them the stress and tension they need to get bigger and stronger. As far as going to failure, I recommend going to failure on every set and doing no more than one set of each exercise.
I find myself talking about what's important or what are the keys quite a bit too. And Howard Marks, the great investor, wrote a book called The Most Important Thing because he couldn't stop telling his clients the most important thing in investing is. So we're all somewhat guilty of that. Is there a reason that you're more of a distance runner rather than a sprinter?
Well, so I no longer do any distance running, if you're asking me personally. I mean, I used to do a lot of it, but I totally switched. I believe that sprinting is a much better way to go about things if somebody wanted to do that. Sprinting itself has a relatively higher risk of injury than some other high-intensity interval training exercises that you can do. I mean, if you're not prepared for it, you can injure yourself sprinting. But with that proviso, sprinting is better than distance running. There's a dichotomy between, some might say, me among them, that there's a false dichotomy between cardio training and resistance training, that, but it all lies on a continuum. So I don't think that with aerobic exercise, such as distance running, that this is like some sort of extra special form of exercise that does this extra special thing. So you have to do it. I mean, that's what people think, but that they have to do cardio, but I don't believe that.
I saw a tweet of yours recently that said the elements of health are the basics: sun, steak, and steel. By steel, you mean plates on a barbell, I assume.
Right.
Is that thought aimed at extending lifespan and health span? Or are those the most important things?
Yes. Yeah, so what happens as we age is that we lose muscle. By the time someone is 80 years old, they can have lost half the muscle that they had when they were younger. And so if you don't do anything about it, you're losing it as you age. Why is that important? Well, it's certainly important in old age, as far as one reason that older people lose their independence and end up institutionalized or something like that in a nursing home, is because, you know, sometimes they literally can't get out of their chair because they don't have enough muscle to do it. Or many of the accidents people have when walking, like falling when they're walking, they don't have the muscle to support themselves properly, or to recover if you trip, to recover from, you know, from a trip. So it's important for old people. But why is it important for people who are younger? And the reason why is because the big correlate with aging is our metabolism. So as people get older, they develop more insulin resistance, their blood sugar is less likely to be controllable, they gain body fat, they lose muscle. So this is meant, you know, the steel part, the lifting weights, is meant to counteract all of that.
I always ask at least one personal finance question. And so my question for you would be, typically people who are disciplined in terms of their diet and exercise abide by the rule that is, how you do anything is how you do everything. So I'm curious if you're a disciplined saver and investor, budgeter, that sort of person.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I consider myself to be pretty frugal, and I have saved and invested all my life. I don't know how successfully, but I have done it. And so I am disciplined that way. Part of my ancestry is Scottish, and we're famous for that.
About Scott-free.
Yes, famous for frugality. So somehow my mother, which is the Scottish side, says, I don't know where he got that, because it wasn't for me. But anyway, I'm definitely on the frugal side and the saving and investing side.
Favorite thing to invest in?
Well, right now, gold and Bitcoin.
Oh, interesting.
You see what they're doing today?
No.
Gold hit an all-time high, and Bitcoin was up $1,000 over the last day or two.
So I know Pomp, the podcast that you were a guest on, and Peter Schiff did a live interview yesterday. I wonder if they had some sort of impact.
Well, who knows? Could very well be. I suppose the American Bitcoin market must be the leading driver of Bitcoin as a whole. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I'm guessing it would be. And so there you have those two talking about it. And maybe gold has been going up since early last year. Early last year, it was something like 1,300. And so now it's well over 1,900. It's had pretty much a blowout in the last couple of weeks. Bitcoin has had its ups and downs, but all of a sudden yesterday and today it's going up quite a lot. So yeah, maybe it did have something to do with it, that podcast.
Do you want to do some fun questions?
Sure. Hopefully I won't say anything too embarrassing.
Where were you the first time you logged onto the internet, and what did you do?
I was at a friend's house, I'm pretty sure, and I was probably 42 years old. So somebody asked me once, how long I've ever been without the internet, and I answered 42 years. What did I do? I remember looking at webcams in various parts of the world. I distinctly remember somebody had set up a webcam in the Antarctic, and I was looking at this, and I thought, isn't that amazing? I can look at what's going on in the Antarctic right now, a live shot.
Very cool.
What else I did, I don't know. I can't remember.
I logged into a chat room at a friend's house. I was 14 years old, and I thought it was so cool that you could chat with people. So this would have been 1993 or 4. Which is more cancerous, sugar or feminism?
I'll be diplomatic. It's sugar.
True or false, within the next 100 years, human lifespans will no longer be finite.
False. They'll be a lot longer, but they will still be finite.
True or false, flexing physically, not like on Instagram, the physical act of flexing is good for your muscles.
Yes, it appears to be. It appears to be a lot of, in a nutshell, yes, it is. It is good. People can have actually done some studies where people have gone through the motions of lifting weights, only they're not using weights, and they get benefits. Their muscles get bigger and stronger.
If Elon Musk colonizes Mars, will you consider going?
Nah.
No. I already know that your favorite book is Walden by Thoreau, so I'm going to deviate slightly from my what is your favorite book question and ask you, if you had to take only the books written by one of these authors, who would you choose? Thomas Sowell, Matt Ridley, or Nassim Taleb? Which author are you taking with you?
Probably Matt Ridley, because I've read several of his, and I've always found them to be very incisive and very thought-provoking. I'd say Matt Ridley. Just read one of his recently that was great.
Which?
The one about innovation.
How innovation works, I believe.
How innovation works, exactly. Very good book.
I've heard you say that a good gauge for your health is for your waist size to be half of your height. So if you are 72 inches tall, that is 6 feet. So ideally you would be 36 inches or less, I imagine, but not too much less. Is that a fair statement?
You know, they're obviously extremes, but 36 would be the maximum you would want to be. So, you know, considerably less probably works too.
Let's say you're on a reality television show where you're in competition with other health coaches for a $2 million prize. Each coach is assigned 2 men and 2 women per team, and both are about 30 pounds overweight per the waist should be half your height rule. And I don't know if you need this information, but let's say they're in their 30s or 40s. What do you tell your team in the first meeting, and what does week one look like?
In other words, so that they can
lose. So you can win the $2 million prize, right?
By slimming them down the fastest.
Yes.
Okay. What I would tell them is don't eat carbohydrates and start lifting weights.
How many times per week in that week one are they lifting weights?
Twice.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And is this an interval training session or heavy weights or go to failure?
This is a high intensity resistance training session going to failure and coupled with a low carbohydrate diet of real whole foods. I'd also tell them to do some intermittent fasting. Yeah.
Excellent. Same prize money, but your team can only focus on exercise or nutrition. Where do you put the focus?
Nutrition, without a doubt. Exercise alone is quite ineffective for losing weight, for losing fat. If you don't get your diet under control, odds are exercise ain't going to make it happen.
I'm going to give you a few names, and I want you to tell me if this person is underrated or overrated. Mike Cernovich.
Uh, He's interesting. I don't know. I don't know if he's underrated or overrated.
Joe Rogan.
Yeah, well, he's interesting too. I mean, I personally, well, you're asking me for a one-word answer here.
You can expound if you like. These okay. are intended to be a little difficult.
Okay. So let me say that I really admire what Joe Rogan has done. I think it is amazing what he's done. He's single-handedly made himself really bigger than any network on television. I mean, if somebody would have told me that somebody was going to do that, I would have said, get out of here. Come on. And he did it. So that is amazing. He's also pretty unfiltered. I mean, he says what's on his mind. And so I admire that as well. That said, I typically hardly ever watch those kind of things. I mean, I get my information from reading. It's a lot faster. I don't need to see people talking about it.
Okay, Dave Portnoy, overrated or underrated?
Underrated, I suppose. I mean, to the extent that I know about him, his I've really only become aware of him in the context of this day trading stuff he's been talking about recently. And you know what? He makes some really good points. I'm not saying I agree with his methods of trading or anything like that. In fact, it pretty much goes against everything I've ever been told. But he made some really good points when he's talking about how it all works and the stonks go up and all this kind of stuff. So, I found that all pretty interesting.
He interviewed Trump a few days ago. I don't know if you had a chance to watch that yet. Fascinating interview.
I should look that up. I saw a photo of the two of them together, but that was all.
Tucker Max.
Yeah. I'll have to say neutral because I'm aware of who he is, but, haven't read much of him or so.
Tim Ferriss.
Boy, I wonder if all these people are going to be listening to this podcast.
Let's hope so.
I like Tim Ferriss. Of course, I paid attention to him. He's, in fact, in some ways, he really has inspired me because, I mean, back when 4-Hour Work Week came out, I was like, wow, somebody really did this, that was really awesome. That was inspiring. So his book 4-Hour Body is quite good. So let's just leave it at that. I like what he's done.
Okay. One more overrated, underrated, and then I'll ask you one last question. James Clear, overrated or underrated?
I think that people are looking for answers. A lot of people want someone to tell them what to do or to give them advice. And James Clear fulfills that function. I have found what I have read of James Clear, which admittedly is not that much, but I've read him online and so on. It's good. Whether he's rated in a certain way by anyone, whether under or over, I don't know.
This was the most insightful overrated, underrated I've ever done, just to let you know.
Okay.
When I was 9 or 10, I was watching one of my brother's baseball teammates putting his bat and glove into his bag. And I saw his arms were so vascular that the veins were popping out. And from that point forward, I had a vision of what I wanted to look like. And so I worked very hard once I was old enough to lift weights to get that vascular look. And I've tried to maintain it. And so I just want to say, after looking at your pictures, you have now given me a vision of what I want to look like in my 60s. So if you're listening and you want to check out this man's work, please, PD, if you could tell them where to go. And I'm going to tell them also to Google image you so they can get a vision for what the future can be. How can they okay. buy your books and find your work online?
Oh, okay. Thanks, Brad. So they probably the best place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is Mangan150. I'm pretty active there. I also have a website, roguehealthandfitness.com. And from there, you could follow a link to my books, which are on Amazon. So that's where they could find me.
Excellent. PD, this was a blast, man. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks a lot, Brad. It was my pleasure.
Friends, I'm always humbled by your listenership. I don't ever take it lightly that you've chosen to spend your time here. If you enjoyed this episode with PD, please copy the link and send it to a friend. And if you wish to follow my adventures on Instagram and Twitter, I'm @man_overseas. Thank you, folks.